You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Hank Dolby Ryan.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Dark Revenant, Chronicle of the Five, Book 1, by Garrick Godrick. A peculiar boy with a remarkable ability, a secret society on a dark crusade, an extraordinary device that could change the world. 14-year-old Cody Calder is a frightened, insecure boy who wants nothing more than to find courage and self-worth. He has a difficult decision to make. He can go with his family and confront his fears or stay behind and hide at his uncle's farm. If he stays, he must say goodbye to the two most important people in his life. If he goes, his decision could change him forever. Cody's choice lands him in a faraway place where he finds himself on an unexpected path filled with mind-bending twists of fate and decision. And Cody's quest for self-discovery becomes a nightmare as he struggles to survive in an extraordinary new world, one he never knew existed. Pick up today, Dark Revenant, Chronicle of the Five, Book 1. We're going to be talking more about this amazing series. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. I am super excited today to have Hank Phillippe Ryan on the show with me. It's the Hank and Hank Show today. Hank has a brand new book that when you're hearing this will be release day. We're recording this a few days early, but today, when you're hearing this, is release day for The Murder List, the latest in her standalone psychological thriller series. And guys, I've been reading an arc of this book this week, and it has completely blown my mind. I read Trust Me last year, Hank, and the new book is a completely different tone from that, but at the same time, right in line with the kinds of stories you tell. And I think we're going to get into that a little bit in this chat. Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much. I love it. I think the Hank and Hank Show has a certain ring to it. I really love that, and I'm very pleased to be here. I love your show. You know I'm a big fan, so honored to be here today.
Well, this is an auspicious day as well as that this show is episode 700 of the Author Stories Podcast, and we are just about a week away from our five-year anniversary.
Well, that's amazing. Congratulations. I mean, that is quite a feat, and it shows such devotion and such care for the community. I mean, you're such a household name, but, you know, people don't realize how difficult this is and how much homework it takes and how much devotion it takes and how much, you know, sort of spirit of storytelling.
Right.
So your enthusiasm is so contagious. Are you hearing those little bells?
Yes.
I think that's another angel getting their wings.
So absolutely. That's what it is. That's another storyteller getting her wings.
I love that. And I do think that, you know, like there's the gold anniversary and the silver anniversary. I think this anniversary for you might be your bestseller anniversary, something like that.
I think that's a pretty great thing to shoot for. Yeah. Hank, we begin each show with the same question each time. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, what a great question. Thank you. Let me just say, first of all, I'm rewinding a tiny bit to what you were saying earlier. Yes, yes, I'm so excited about The Murder List. This is stunning and stellar, and the reviews have been amazing. And The Murder List is a psychological standalone, and we can talk about that first. But gosh, my first thoughts of being a writer, that's kind of a funny, complicated story in a great kind of way. Tess Gerritsen always talks about how she and her pals, her fellow writers, sort of self-selected when they were maybe seven, that they knew that this is what they wanted to be, was a writer. And I kind of went a different path than that. I grew up in really rural Indiana, so rural that you couldn't see another house from our house. And my sister and I used to ride our ponies to the library and get books from the library. And then we'd read up in the hayloft of the barn behind our house. And that's where I fell in love with storytelling. That's where I fell in love with storytelling. That's where I fell in love with the idea that a mystery author could lure you in and treat you to a good story, and in the end could surprise and delight you with an ending that seemed like such a surprise, but then it was inevitable when you looked back on it. So I started, as we all do, on Nancy Drew and then Sherlock Holmes. I was immersed with the rhythm and the music of Sherlock Holmes, and then Agatha Christie, you know, wow, the fireworks started and the lights went off. And I remember reading Murder on the Orient Express, and I thought, really? How did she do that? But interestingly, and to your point, it isn't that I wanted to be a mystery writer at that point. I wanted to be a detective. I'd rather have been Nancy Drew at that point than write about Nancy Drew. And I kind of think that's what led me to journalism. I mean, that is sort of solving a mystery every day. You're tracking down clues and following leads and then writing the story of it, right? Writing the true story of it. So fast forwarding like crazy, the moment that I decided that I wanted to be a mystery author was in 2004-ish, maybe something like that. And I just had a really good idea. And you know when you have a good idea and you get goosebumps. And I came home and I said to my husband, you know, I'm gonna write a mystery novel. I love mysteries. I'm gonna write a mystery novel. And Jonathan looked at me like I had lost my mind. And he says, sweetheart, do you know how to write a mystery? And I'm like, how hard can it be? You know, I've read a million of these. And I've heard other authors say this, that, you know, in their moment of sort of naivete and newbiness, you know, you think about, well, it's a book. It's a kind of book that you love. I love mysteries and love thrillers. And you think you know how to do it. And so with that, you know, utter confidence of the newbie, you know, the crazy, weird, wrong confidence of a newbie, I just plowed right into it. And it was quite an adventure, I have to say. But that book turned out to be Prime Time, my first novel, which won the Agatha for Best Mystery. And that was the beginning of my career. So, you know, where did it start? In answer to your question, I know it started in the hayloft of that barn. I just didn't know how long it would take for that love to blossom into actually writing a book. And now The Murder List is my 11th novel, which is just so crazy and wonderful, crazy wonderful to think about.
Absolutely. You know, the path to storytelling is different for everyone. I believe that there's a storytelling gene, or there's something that shapes people to be storytellers, and it can take all sorts of shapes. And a storyteller may decide to be a writer, and then, you know, you hone a specific skill set that then plays on the storytelling gene. And I'm saying that in air quotes, because we know it's not a gene, but there's something about people that want to communicate to other people in that way. You know, I believe your storytelling ability has shown itself for several decades in the day work that you do. I heard this fantastic story that you told one time about going to a television station when you were in your 20s and applying for a job, but you didn't have any experience. Would you tell the audience about that story?
Oh, that is a great story. I love that you listened to me. That's so cute, Hank. Thank you. I had decided that when I got out of college as a Shakespeare major, if you can imagine, much to my parents' chagrin, they're like, honey, you don't really have any skills. You know, I'm sure it's lovely that you know everything about Shakespeare, but that's not going to get you, and you have to move out. So anyway, I decided I wanted to change the world, and I went into politics right out of college and worked in several political campaigns back home in Indiana. But sadly, no candidate I ever worked for actually won. And that is sort of the universe telling you to find another career. And, you know, what I was doing in those campaigns was I was writing press releases and doing advance work and that kind of thing. So I was seeing the world working and seeing the world unfolding a little bit. It was good experience. But when my final candidate lost, he was not going to be the governor of Indiana, and I was not going to be the press secretary to the governor of Indiana. And he was out of a job, and I was out of a job. So I went to the biggest radio station. It was radio in 1970, it was in Indianapolis, and 1970 is important. 1970 is important. And I said to the news director, I'm here to apply for a job as a reporter. And I see you have an opening. And the news director said, well, yes, we do. We do have an opening for a reporter. When was your last radio job? And I said, well, no, I didn't really have a job in radio. And he said, oh, well, okay. Did you work in television or newspapers? No. Magazines? No. Oh, were you have you ever done an interview? He asked me, have you ever done a story or written an article, anything like that? And I had to admit that I hadn't. And he said, oh, well, maybe you just graduated from journalism school. And I'm like, no. You can see where this interview is going.
Exactly.
This poor guy must have just been so baffled that I walked into his newsroom. So finally, after he finally says, when you were a little girl, did you hand out mimeograph newspapers door to door in your neighborhood? No, I didn't even do that. You know, I was up in the hayloft reading. And so finally, he just, you know, sort of threw up his hands and said, you know, I'm so sorry. You seem like a perfectly nice young woman, but you have no experience. We just can't hire you at this radio station with no experience. And he said, can you tell me one reason why we should hire you? Just one. And I said, well, yes, I can. I said, your license is up for renewal right now at the Federal Communications Commission, and you don't have any women working here. And then I just smiled. And the next day, I had my first job in broadcasting. So, you know, I guess threatening your potential employer with a lawsuit on day one is not really the way that I would suggest for people who want to get into journalism. Try it. And it's interesting about that, because that took a lot of nerve. I think back then, I'm not sure I would have had the gumption to do that now. But I had done my homework, and I think he realized that I had studied, you know, that I knew my stuff and that I was confident. I guess it came across as confident. And the thing that kills me about that now, two things. The equal opportunity laws had just passed and were changing the world. And I knew that that had happened. And I knew that they didn't have any women working there. And I knew that they had to. So the law helped me in that situation. And my understanding of the research and the research into the law helped me. But I was also really brave at that moment. You know, I took a chance, and I was brave, and I kind of found my calling. And the calling was storytelling, completely. That's what I've done every day for the past now 43 years, is tell a story, you know, briefly in radio and then at Rolling Stone magazine and then on television since 1975. Tell a story every day, a fascinating, interesting, important, riveting, you know, beginning, middle, and end with a problem that needs to be solved and a character who you care about. You know, you want the good guys to win and the bad guys to get what's coming to them. You're uncovering secrets and revealing secrets. And in the end, you want some justice and you want to change the world a little bit. So that's what I've been doing every day for all these years, making a little movie, making a story for television. And that has translated so beautifully into writing crime fiction like The Murder List. All that experience, all that storytelling, all that kind of understanding of what an audience wants and enjoys. I mean, to be educated and enlightened and entertained at the same time, to feel like your life has changed as a result of telling this story. You know, and that's very powerful to me.
Absolutely. In your time working as an investigative reporter, you have garnered 36 Emmys, 14 Edward R. Murrow Awards, dozens of other honors for your journalism. When you show up to work every day, is it like being a novelist in that you have a blank slate when each kind of project is wrapped up and you're looking for the next thing? Are those skills similar where – you know, the novelist is brainstorming and looking for the what ifs. Does a journalist look for those same what ifs and maybe smell out something and then follow that? Are the two processes similar?
Oh, so certainly so. I mean, what a wonderful way of looking at it. I'm just smiling at the 36 Emmys. You've got to imagine me here. I'm in my study in West Newton, Massachusetts, with the maple tree out of my window, my bay window, and behind me on the bookshelves are 36 Emmys. And some days when I'm having a bad writing day, I just sort of look at those and look at my 5 Agatha Awards, and I think, well, some days it works, you know, some days it does. But, you know, the idea of the parallel processing of a news story and a crime fiction story and the sort of blink reflex that you have of knowing what a good story is a mysterious and powerful thing. And I think over the years, I have kind of honed that. You know, I get hundreds of emails every week and phone calls and letters and all kinds of things with story tips and story ideas. And I can go through them very quickly and say, nope, 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 nope. Oh, yeah. You know, that could be something. And that's what is it that makes that click happen, whether it's fictional or whether it's in reporting. You have to have sort of curiosity to wonder why that would be that way, or whether the system doesn't work properly, or whether one problem, you know, is the tip of the iceberg of a bigger problem, you know. And that's exactly the same thing that happens in crime fiction too, when the dominoes start falling in a story, whether it's a crime fiction story or whether it's a news story, and you follow the path where it leads. Somebody told me once that writing a good story was like leaving gold coins for the reader along a forest path, that you know that there'll be the next gold coin and the next gold coin and the next gold coin, the next bit of treasure. And that's what keeps you reading. And that's what keeps me searching for the good stories. You know, when I'm on the trail of a good story, doors start opening. People start saying, yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. Exactly the same way as writing in crime fiction. When the story seems to work, there's a way that the story will unfold. And that's exactly what happens in writing investigative reporting. In investigative reporting as well, there's this feeling that the story is going to work. And that's not to say, and any reporter and any author will tell you this, that's not to say that it's easy. You know, there is nothing, I would never use the word easy when it comes to this. But there's an understanding and a faith, if I can use the word, that by persevering and just to keep going and being determined, that you have this feeling that at the end of the story tunnel is the answer. And I have had sometimes in my reporting career when I think, you know, this story just isn't going to work. Not often, but sometimes. And I just tuck it away for later or never, because things don't always work. In writing crime fiction, you have a longer time to write a story. And so since I don't have an outline, and I can make stuff up, you know, that's a key, unlike journalism, I can sort of ebb and flow my storytelling and ebb and flow the story and change it. Unlike in investigative reporting, when a fact is a fact and that's what it is. So that's the big difference. That's the big difference. In crime fiction, I can just make someone do whatever I want them to do if the fictional character agrees to do it. And when I'm telling you a true story as an investigative story, it is what it is. And it's just a question of making sure that's true. So that's the biggest difference. And quickly, let me just say, I wondered when I started writing fiction whether my reporter brain would let me make stuff up. But that was the thing that was new. That was the thing that was new, was that I was creating a whole new world out of things that didn't exist.
Right.
And could I do that?
Well, and I would imagine that tension exists on the other side as well. Like, you know, as an investigative reporter, I don't want my novelist brain to kick in.
That's, you know, as a reporter, that's such a funny question. I'm thinking about this. As a reporter, you have kind of wishes, sort of, wouldn't it be cool if this was the case, or wouldn't it be cool if that was the case, or wouldn't it be funny if that was the case? But the reporter journalist training lets you just laugh that off. You know, you say, well, let me see if that's true. You're not wanting a story to be, you're seeing what it is. And those are two different things.
I've had the privilege to meet a number of journalists, reporters, investigative reporters who have become novelists. And I'm always fascinated by the cross section, the intersection of these skills. And, you know, a great reporter will highlight something that's maybe mundane. Maybe it's right under all of our noses. Maybe you have an event that happens and 10 reporters show up and they cover this event and all 10 of their stories are a little different because there's something that jumps out to them that then they highlight to the rest of us, the people that did not see this thing. And we get a mental picture, sometimes a physical picture on television. But we get a picture painted of this event that happened. How do you feel like being a reporter and an investigative reporter specifically has honed your ability to tell a story and to bring things to the reader that they might not get anywhere else?
Well, I can tell you when in the days when I was a general assignment reporter, when I was came in the morning and was sent out to cover whatever it was, whether it was fires or murders or the cat show or the basketball finals. Every time I'd see my colleagues' stories, every one of them was different, and every one of them was different from mine because we brought a different sensibility to it and we cared about it in a different way. There are two things that I think are so important about writing, doing investigative reporting. One is to sort of vet the stories by thinking, why do I care about this? Because that's what makes a story be powerful. It has to be important and it has to be meaningful and it has to make a difference in someone's life. You know, we did a big story, for instance, about how the 911 system in Massachusetts was sending emergency responders, police and firefighters, to the wrong address thousands of times a year. And the state wasn't fixing it and the state didn't even know the extent to which this was happening. And that story all began because I got a phone call from a woman who said that she had called an ambulance for her choking son. He turned out to be fine. He turned out to be fine, but the ambulance never arrived. And when she called to say, "Where are you? Where are you?" they said, "Well, we're at your house, 110 Main Street." And she said, "Well, that's not where I live." And she said to me, the ambulance went to the wrong place. Can you believe that?" And I thought, if it happened to her, that means it's happened to other people. This isn't going to be a one-time only incident. And that little tweak of an idea was what led me to this truly blockbuster, life-changing story. Because you care about that woman and her son. And the idea that any of us could call an ambulance and it would show up at the wrong address, that's just devastating. So I ask myself every day as an investigative reporter, why do I care about this story? And how can I bring this story home to other people to show why they care about it? And that's what's so important. I say to my interns, it's not what a story is. It's what it means, if I could put it that way. And it's the same with a novel. You know, if the heat is broken in someone's house, the heat is broken. But what does that mean? You know, it means that it's going to be cold. It means that the children are going to be cold. It means that their lives are going to be changed and altered. That everything they do will be to keep warm now that the heater is broken, if you see what I mean. So what it is that the heater is broken. What it means is that people will be freezing and in danger and unhappy and upset and nervous and worried and distracted and possibly in danger. So that's what I try to do with both my investigative stories and my novels. You know, I try to figure out why I care. And when I'm reading my stories and when I'm reading my novels, if I'm editing it and I find myself sort of reading fast or skimming, I think, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. I don't care about this. What can I do to make me care? And if I care, the reader will care.
Well, the bottom of my monitor and up the sides on the casing of the monitor is littered with sticky notes where when I hear a nugget of wisdom, I write it down and I stick it to my monitor to save forever. And I just wrote down, why do I care about this, and stuck it to my monitor. I think that when it comes to moving a narrative forward, if we ask ourselves that all the way through the book, that will remedy so many so many problems with the story if we're constantly asking, why do I care about this?
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be on your monitor. That's quite great. But it does work. I mean, what it often results in is cutting out a lot of stuff, you know, because you can, as I said, but since I don't have an outline, sometimes I find when I'm writing, I'm just sort of getting myself to another place. And I'm writing something that's really just transition, just in sort of interstitial. And when I take that out, you know, the story that I meant to write emerges. When I take out the part where, you know, Elmore Leonard and the parts people skip, I say, I don't write the parts people don't care about.
Your novelist career began with Primetime, which then became the Charlotte McNally series. And then you had another series, the Jane Ryland thriller series. But your last two books, Trust Me and the brand new book, The Murder List, are standalones. How do you feel like writing standalones frees you up creatively in ways that writing a series can't?
Oh, it was such a revelation, Hank, to write standalones. Quickly, the reason that I wrote Trust Me as a standalone was that I had this really great idea for a book. And, you know, that's how everyone starts. I can tell you every book I had, where the moment was that I got the idea for it was. And I got the idea for Trust Me quickly. I mean, I've wired myself with hidden cameras and I've confronted corrupt politicians and I've gone undercover and in disguise. But I got the idea for Trust Me at the kitchen table, listening to my husband practice a closing argument in a big murder trial. He's a criminal defense attorney. And I thought, oh, sweetheart, you know, you're so good. You're so smart. This is so persuasive. The story you're telling is so true that the jury can do nothing but find your client not guilty. I said, this is a slam dunk acquittal. And then I thought about the prosecutor's wife sitting across town, right? Listening to her husband give his closing argument in the same case. And did she say to him, oh, sweetheart, it's a slam dunk conviction? You know, I thought, each one is telling a story that they want the jury to believe is true, but there can only be one truth, only be one truth. There can't be two truths. And then I thought, well, maybe there can, and maybe there's three sides to every story, yours, mine, and the truth, because the prosecutor and the defense attorney are telling you the truth they want the jury to know, but probably the reality is somewhere in between. And I thought, oh, my book. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of Trust Me. How can there be two truths? And that could not be a Jane Ryland thriller. It just had a bigger feel. It had definitely a psychological feel, very gaslighty, very manipulative, very deceptive, very psychological. And so It just wasn't a Jane Ryland book. And I knew it had to be a standalone because a standalone to me is the most important thing that's ever happened in the characters' lives, right? There'll never be anything as big as this. So, you know, I said to my editor, I've got this idea for a standalone. Here it is. And she's like, oh yeah, we want, you know, put everything down. We want that now. And that turned out to be Trust Me, which was a best of the year and, you know, BookBub and Real Simple and the New York Post and all kinds of Criminal Element, all kinds of places, Bustle and Pop Sugar, all kinds of wonderful places. So The Murder List, my new book, The Murder List, it was the same kind of thing. And my darling husband, you know, I got the idea from him again. I was thinking about what he does. He's so benevolent and so good. And he takes on a lot of really hopeless murder cases, ones where, you know, he's standing up for the little guy because the system has to work. And I thought how devoted he is to be a lawyer that stands up for the little guy. And then I thought, well, the other lawyers, the prosecutors, you know, they think they're the good guys too. You know, they're protecting the public. They're bringing criminals to justice. They think they're the good guys. And I thought, how can everybody be a good guy? Because it's what they perceive as being good. And I started really being riveted about what good meant and what lawyers think when they call themselves the good guy and how it's all about winning to lawyers. You know, you need to win a case. If you ask the lawyer what's a good case, they'll say it's a winnable case, a winnable case. So their key is winning. So how far would someone go to win? So in the Murrah list, I have Rachel North, a young law student, who's married to Jack Kirkland, who's a big, a successful criminal defense attorney. And Rachel also has a summer job as an intern in the prosecutor's office. And how those three stories come together. It seems like the prosecutor and the defense attorney are vying for the legal soul of this young law student. But that's just what they think they're doing. in all my books, I call them Trojan horse stories because you aren't really reading what you think you're reading. But your question was standalones. So in a series, like in the Jane Ryland series, you know that the conflict of the book for readers is not going to come with the possibility that main character Jane Ryland is going to die.
Right.
Because she's got to come back in book six. So,
right. Because series is right there on the cover.
Exactly. So we are telling you by putting series on the cover, the main character is not going to die. So that, you know, you can have all kinds of wonderful adventures and you can have it be scary and you can have it be suspenseful. But the challenge for a series writer is that ultimate high stakes will not be faced. No matter what rigors the main character goes through, they're going to come out okay. That's a tough thing to create that suspense time after time after time after time for the same person. But in a standalone, oh my golly, anything goes. Anybody could be good. Anybody could be bad. Anybody could be seemingly good but actually bad, or seemingly bad but actually good. Anyone could be lying. Anyone could be guilty, and anyone could die. Anyone. I mean, I'm a big Game of Thrones fan. George R. R. Martin will kill anyone. I mean, anybody, right? And you think, and I think about that all the time as I'm writing my standalone. Just like anything goes. I could kill anyone. I could make anyone guilty. I could do anything. It's freeing in one way. It's powerful in another way. It's scary in another way because it is all on the table in this book. You will never see Rachel and Jack and Martha again. You will never see them again. This is their story. This is the moment in their lives when everything forever changed. And that's what a standalone is. And that's what I love about the Murrah list. The reader is on the journey with these three people, figuring out what they want and how far they'll go to get it. It's very exciting. And it was very exciting to write. I had no idea what the ending would be. None. And when I figured out the ending, I stood up in my office and I applauded. I was by myself. I'm like, yes, you figured this out. And then I thought, sit down. You know, you're alone. It's fine. But it was a joy to write this book. Very difficult, as I kept saying, you know, nothing is easy, but it's amazing to write a standalone. It's a jewel. I mean, it's a completely matchless experience.
As I mentioned earlier, the new book, The Murrah List, is a very different book from Trust Me. Yet as you get into the story, it feels very much like your book. Your DNA is all over this book in the way that you twist the story and the way that you build tension constantly. And the way that you keep us caring about these characters and what's going to happen next, and even to the point of, you know, how do I as the reader fit into this story? What do I feel about how things are going? It really challenges you the more you read, and while entertaining you, which is a very difficult feat to really get to ponder things while being entertained. The characters in Trust Me, that the book opens, you know, with a very stunning scene. She's, you know, writing with her finger in the mirror and counting the days that she, you know, has lost her family. How long has it been? And that really sets the emotional tone for that book. With The Murrah List, it's a very different opening scenario. Rachel and her husband are sitting at the breakfast table, and he's forbidding her to take this internship, and it's, you know, and you hear her internal monologue and about how this is going to you know, advance her career. And it's just an extremely different tone in the beginning of this book, and the characters come across very differently. It's I don't want to say it's more lighthearted in tone, but it is at the beginning, the murder list. How do you, when you start thinking of the characters that are going to live in the world of this book, how do you start, you know, looking at their character traits and what makes them who they are?
You know, that's a really wonderful way of looking at it. And I was thinking about this as you were describing it. You know, in Trust Me, the first scene, Mercer Hennessy, as you said, is writing in the condensation of the bathroom mirror, 442. The number of days since her family was killed in a car accident, the number of days actually since she's been happy. You know, that's what she's counting. That's her ritual. And because the engine of Trust Me is grief, things happen in Trust Me out of grief and remorse and guilt. And so that tone at the beginning of Trust Me, that scene at the beginning of Trust Me sets the tone for the motivation of the book, because grief is what the book is about and what we do as a result of grief and how, you know, deep felt grief affects every decision we make. You know, it makes us not be able to trust ourselves because we're so unhappy. And we all know how that feels. In The Murder List, the first scene is ambitious, right? Rachel, young law student Rachel, is ambitious. She wants this big career. She wants what she wants. She wants her faithful husband, and she wants her powerful boss, and she wants to make a name for herself as a lawyer. So the root, the engine of The Murder List is ambition and winning. And that's what the first scene is all about. It's about wanting to win, that her husband Jack wants to win, and it's a fight that Rachel says, I have to win. And it sets the tone of the book of being about winning. So it's contentious, right? That's what it is. They're on the verge of having an argument. And that's the tone of the book too. It's all about argument, all about winning, all about ambition, all about how far will you go to get what you want. So I love that you picked that up in both books. Yay. You know, it makes me feel like I did something so right. Thank you. Because that's the tone. That's the tone of the book. So thank you. That's great. That's great. It always is so much fun to talk about books after you write them, because
I know because you're like, oh yeah, I did that on purpose.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And like smart readers will tell you what you wrote, and you're like, I'm like, yeah, sure, definitely.
Sure, that's exactly what I meant.
Yeah, I mean, somebody asked me a couple of days ago why I decided to do such and such in a book. And I said, you use this word decided. You know, I'm not sure that was exactly what happened, but all works out fine, knock on wood.
Right. Hank, we are all surrounded by story ideas. And one of the worst questions to ask a writer is, where do you get your ideas from? Because ideas are everywhere. If you just close your mouth and listen long enough, there are story ideas all over the place. But there is something about the idea that rises above all the others and becomes alive in a storyteller's mind. What is it about the idea that strikes you when you see something, when you hear something? Maybe you're just playing out what ifs in your mind. What is it that brings an idea alive to you?
Oh my golly. I mean, is that not the magical, mystical question of the world? You know, I always think about ideas, where do they come from even? You know, you're sitting there thinking or not thinking, and all of a sudden something comes to you that wasn't there before. You know, I just don't understand why that is. And I can tell you that I agree with you so thoroughly that I can go through a million ideas and say, nope, 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 nope. Or I can also try to convince myself, well, I can make that work. You know, it's fine. But it, you know, fine is bad. Fine isn't going to work. But, you know, sometimes I'll write it fine, knowing that I can change it later. And I always say, you know, if I just have one good idea a day, I'm incredibly grateful. And I know, you know, the feeling of it. You just think, oh, yeah, that'll work. That'll work. It's like sometimes, you know, you take an idea pebble and drop it into the idea pond. It just plops to the bottom, you know, just sinks. And sometimes the ripples go out and out and out, and you can see what would happen as a result of that, and what would happen as a result of that, and what would happen as a result of that. And then you think, oh, yeah, that's going to work. You know, that, and it's often the surprising thing. It's often the unexpected thing, like not the first unexpected thing, but maybe like the third unexpected thing. Sometimes I do it by playing with relationships. You know, if you take the triangle in The Murder List, if you take the triangle of Jack and Rachel and Martha, if you put Rachel as the apex of a triangle, how does that connect Jack and Martha? But if you put Jack at the apex of the triangle, how does that connect Rachel and Martha? You know, if you put Martha at the apex of the triangle, how does that connect Jack and Rachel? You know, are they allies? Are they embattled? Are they hurting each other or helping each other? You know, that triangle structure, and I played with that all through The Murder List, because how each person acts to the other, that's what drives that story. And I can tell you that there were so many ideas of how those relationships would work that changed. You know, the idea of ideas, we could talk about that forever, because that is, I don't understand that. I don't understand how a writer brain works, and I don't understand how we know when it's right. And I don't understand what makes us sit bolt upright in the middle of the night thinking, oh, I have a good idea. And how we crave that and need that and want that. That's the engine of our lives, isn't it? Having a good idea.
You've mentioned that you don't write with an outline as you're writing the book. And I love that freedom of discovery as the story's just coming alive, and you almost feel like a reporter that's following the story and writing down what's happening. But what some people have a problem with in writing that way is that the story gets away from them, and they wind up taking rabbit trails that don't go anywhere, and you waste a lot of time and you know, quote unquote paper, chasing down something that doesn't work. How do you, as a writer who is a discovery writer, keep the story in check and keep the storyline tight, so that you don't waste a bunch of time chasing things that don't work?
Well, it's funny, you know, I have stickies on my computer too, and I'm looking at them right now, and one of them says advance the today plot, meaning keep the story going. So that's, another sticky says psychological deceptive manipulation. So sort of anything that isn't that, anything that doesn't advance the story, and anything that isn't psychological, deceptive, or manipulation, that isn't going to be in there. So I, again, going back, rewinding to what we were talking about earlier, I say, why do I care? And how does this matter to the story? How does this advance the story? Am I just riffing here because I think I'm such a good writer? Just that means instantly take it out. Or am I trying to make my word count for the day by describing some buildings? You know, you don't need that. Just take that out. So sometimes I just leave it and take it out later. Almost in almost all of my books, the first horrible, disgusting, hilarious, ridiculous first draft might be 120,000 words. But I don't send it to my editor until it's maybe 106,000 words. Because I just, you know, they talk about killing your darlings. I hate those words. I don't think they're darling at all. You know, if they're clogging my story and stopping the pacing, I love taking them out. Take them out, take them out, take them out. So editing is when my story comes alive. And editing is when I take out those parts that you're exactly the part that you're talking about. The parts that are sort of tangential and not the trunk of the tree and not what the story is really about. You know, all those things. I used to keep a file of them, the things that I took out. And then once I started doing that, I realized all that stuff was terrible. You know, it was repetitive or derivative or cliched or the purple bruised sky on the golden hydrangea or whatever, just junky made up descriptions. It just all didn't matter. It was all bad. Or me trying to be a good writer, just take all that out. And it's almost like, Michelangelo, whoever, talked about sculpting, that you just take away everything that isn't the story. You take away everything that isn't the statue, he said. And I take away everything that isn't the story. And I think that's what keeps me on the track. I say, is this the story? Yes. Is this the story? No. And that really works for me, knock on wood.
Well, with the murder list, you have nailed that process perfectly, because I cared in every scene about this, and I wanted to know what happened next when I turned the page. I absolutely love it. I'm a huge fan, Hank. We could sit here and talk all day, I believe. If people are just learning about you and about the work that you do, is there a place where they can find you online, dig into your back catalog, and follow along with news and events?
Oh, of course. Thank you. Yeah, and I do think we could talk forever. This has been, the time has flown.
It has.
My website is cleverly named HankPhillippiRyan.com. Imagine. We have it all spelling, so you can't get it wrong. I'm on Facebook. Please find me on my website. There's a newsletter. Just sign up for the newsletter. I promise I won't send you many, but there'll be lots of giveaways and drawings and prizes. Facebook, my Facebook author page. Instagram, I'm sadly, tragically on Instagram all the time. I love, if you go to my website and click on contact, it comes right to me with no middle person. That email will come right to me. I'm going on tour for the Murder List. My launch, as you said, is today, the 20th, but I'll be on tour, oh golly, for almost a month-ish. So look at my website on events and come see me. That would just be amazing. I love to hear from readers. I love to see them. The reviews have been so phenomenal. Library Journal starred review, and CNN chose it as an ultimate beach read, chose the Murder List as an ultimate beach read. CNN, so that's kind of amazing, and all kinds of wonderful reviews from AP and the Providence Journal, and I'm thrilled, thrilled, thrilled. But when I see the NetGalley reviews and the BookBub reviews and the Goodread reviews and the Amazon reviews from real readers who are like, I couldn't believe it, hashtag that ending. I love this book, as you're saying, and I'm so grateful for that. That's the fuel of this. That's what gets me up at 4 a.m. to go on the next plane, is that this book is working. It's working. The Murder List is working, and I'm so thrilled about that.
Well, The Murder List is definitely one of the my favorite books that I've read this year, and I'm a huge mystery thriller fan. And I started this podcast because I love books and I love writers, and I want to introduce more people to the things that I love. And this is the prime objective of that. This book, I love it so much. I want everyone to go buy a copy of it. There's a link to it in the show notes, as well as we'll put links to all of your social media and all of that in the show notes as well. Hank, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Fun for me too. Absolutely. And I'm so honored and grateful to be invited on the show. And happy anniversary. Congratulations.
Thanks for tuning in to the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dream coat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh, she'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whorls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.